You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
All right, so let's jump into our passage for today. And if you've been here with us, you've heard me give the same introduction, you know, each week, because the context of this book is so important. Peter, who is our author, is writing to a group of scattered Christians. And the topic is the persecution that they're facing. And so he's been giving them all of these instructions about how to respond, what to do, how to head off some of the grief that they're getting for being followers of Jesus in their context, their social context, where they're getting rejection because of this. And last week, we kind of turned into a new section where he began talking to them about suffering. And I said, it's almost as if this section is like, okay, Peter, what if we take all your directions? What if we follow all your instructions about being, you know, just awesome members of society, and yet we still face persecution? And so at this point, he's telling them, look, you need to have the right attitude about the possibility of suffering. You need to have what we said, what he called to arm yourself with a willingness or a mind to suffer. And that's the chunk that we studied last week in chapter 4, 1 through verse 19. But what we're going to do this week is go back, because we skipped over a piece. Right in the middle of this instruction about being ready to suffer and having the mentality like Jesus had about laying your life down sacrificially for other people, right in the middle of that is sort of this parenthesis about love. And I don't think that it's unrelated at all. You know, it fits right in the flow of thought that if we're going to have an attitude that is ready to endure trials, a big piece of that is love. In other words, a big piece of that is that we know how to take care of each other. That's one of our great superpowers. You know, how can we endure trials? How can we follow the tough road that Jesus calls us to follow? Well, one of the ways is we love each other. And in fact, it's a big way. And that's why I set it aside so we could spend a whole week on these few verses here. So let's read it together. Verse 7, I think, sets the mood, all right? Peter says, "The end of all things is near. Therefore, be of sound judgment and sober spirit for the purpose of prayer." Boy, you could get far just meditating on that verse all by itself, especially because it kind of comes at you out of the blue. What's he saying? He's reminding them that, look, today may be what today is, with all its good things and bad things, but today ain't the whole picture. That's what he's saying. He's saying the end of all things is near. Remember, there is a day coming soon when Jesus returns, when this whole setup changes. And that we should focus on that. That the human story has a trajectory and it has a terminus. And this isn't the end of the story. And I think that that's very important to remember, that that there's more to come. Something I've been saying lately, you know, something will come up that just, you know, life has these intractable problems sometimes that just feel like nothing's going to solve this. We've had, you know, here's a conflict in our home church, and it's the same conflict we've dealt with 100 times, and here it is again, and these two people just can't get along. And, you know, I said to them, I said, well, I don't know whether we're going to get it worked out or not, but I know this, you know, I'm 44 now, so I figure within the next 40 years or so, we're all going to be in the same home church in heaven together, one way or another. And I said, you know, guys, I don't know if we're going to get it figured out before then, but we'll get it figured out by then at least. And so, you know, better to figure it out now, but if we have to wait till then, we'll wait till then, because after all, the end of all things is near, right? There's this sort of eternal perspective that the main goal of things is over the hill, not right here in the circumstances today. Therefore, he says, to be of sound judgment, like let that influence your thinking. Operate with that in view, that the culmination of everything is to come, and it's to come soon. And so be sober in spirit. Let that impact how you live and how you think. And pray, of course, because the interacting with the eternal is such an important component of getting this life right. And so I think, you know, think about this advice, how this would come across to people who are facing persecution. He's like, guys, remember, we're about to, you know, sooner or later, we're going to turn into the next chapter, which is eternal. And so you, yes, you're under pressure. Yes, you're in a pressure cooker and you're being rejected and you're having to handle all these impossible situations. You're being mistreated. But hold on. You know, it's like he's describing a sort of focused anticipation and perseverance under pressure. The thing this always makes me think of, do you remember that part in Return of the Jedi when they, I know, don't act like you haven't seen Return of the Jedi. They blow up the Death Star from the inside. Remember this? And it's blowing up with chain reaction, and they're flying the Millennium Falcon out. And as they're flying out, the fire keeps getting closer and closer, and then pretty soon it's creeping around their field of vision, and they're just kind of holding on, going as fast as they can. And you're like, are they going to make it out? And at the last second, they shoot out of there, and the thing explodes. That scene goes on forever, you know, and I just think that's like what he's describing is like, I know this is uncomfortable, but fix your hope on where you're going and hang on, a focused anticipation and perseverance under pressure. You're in the pressure cooker, Peter says, but hold on. And then he says this, he says, above all, keep fervent in your love for one another, because love covers a multitude of sins. Be hospitable to one another without complaint. As each one has received a special gift, employ it in serving one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. Whoever speaks is to do so as one who is speaking the utterances of God. Whoever serves is to do so as one who is serving by the strength which God supplies, so that in all things God may be glorified through Jesus Christ, to whom belongs the glory and dominion forever and ever. Amen. So this is this parenthesis in the middle of his discussion on suffering. And what's it about? It's about love. He says, above all, keep fervent in your love for one another. In other words, love for one another is essential survival skill for enduring the pressure cooker. If you want to go through the hard things in this life, one thing you need above all is love for each other. If you're going to follow Jesus and the footsteps that he left for us to follow and his example, as Peter's been describing, then you're going to need love for one another. And I think that it's really interesting that he says above all. You know, so it's a priority. We've said a lot in this chapter about suffering. It's important that you have the right mentality. It's important that you entrust yourself to God. It's important that you understand eternity. But above all that, if you forget everything else we've said, remember this, make sure that you take care of each other. Make sure that you love each other. This is what he's saying. And so all we're going to do is go back through this chunk that we just read and call out a few aspects of this love. What kind of love should we have for one another? That's what he describes in this passage. And so the first thing is that it is a priority. It's above all. It's the most important thing. You can't go wrong if you move loving others up to the front of the line in your life. It'll probably serve you well. He says to keep fervent in your love, which is a really interesting term, fervent love. What does that mean? That word is ektenes, which sometimes is translated zealous. You know, zealous is passionate. That word is connected to the word jealous. Although jealousy is bad, whereas zeal is like sort of the you know, jealous is the evil twin and zeal is the good twin, right? An appropriate longing. And it also can mean stretched out. Where you see this word used a lot in ancient literature is when they describe athletic competition. So in a race, when the runners come down the finish line and they can see the end and they go out into a dead sprint, that word would be ektenes. They're stretched out. And I think that's a very vivid you know, to love one another full stretch. You know, don't just, you know, kind of tip your hat toward one another. He's like, go all out. Love one another in a dead sprint. And I'll be honest, I find this convicting, because if you say, Ben, do you love your brothers and sisters? You know, do you love the people in this room? Yes, of course I do. Okay, but do you love them in a dead sprint? Not usually, you know. It's more like sort of a strolling, walking, a meandering type of love. He's like, no, you go all out, full stretch. And he says to keep fervent, which is even harder. You know, if you can sprint, that's great. Good for you. It's one thing to sprint. It's another thing to sustain a sprint, though. That's hard. You can stretch out your arm, okay? But if I say, now keep your arm stretched out, that becomes very difficult. Have you ever tried to work in a kid's mouth, like to help them get a loose tooth out? I feel bad for dentists who work with little kids, because they say, open your mouth. And the kid's like, ah, they open their mouth so wide. But as soon as you get in there, what happens? Their mouth gets tired and it starts to close. And so, you know, I'm like, open your mouth, open your mouth. And I sang it over and over. I remember helping my son get his tooth out. I kept saying, you're biting me. You know, open your mouth, stop biting me. Okay, you're biting me again, that hurts. You know, and he would remember each time and open his mouth. It's hard to keep fervent at anything. And so he's like, guys, above all, remember this one thing. Put your attention, your sober, focused attention on staying fervent in your love for one another. It reminds me of chapter 1, verse 22. Peter's kind of cool. This book is neat because it sort of spirals. You know, Paul will often cover a topic and then move on and not return to it. Peter likes to introduce topics and then return and develop them later. So this idea actually appeared first in chapter 1:22. He said, since you have in obedience to the truth purified your souls for a sincere love of the brethren, fervently love one another from the heart. He's like, since you've obeyed the gospel, if you're saved, then your first order of business, the purpose you're saved for, he says, is a sincere love of the brethren. So fervently love one another from the heart. And this word that he's using is agape, a familiar word to you if you've studied very much New Testament. It's one of the many words for love that they had, but it's one that a lot of scholars think that Christians kind of co-opted this lesser used term for love to describe, you know, their own Christian brand of love. It's different than brotherly love. It's different than friendship love. It's different than romantic love. It's a godly love. It's love like Jesus had, who loved everyone, who laid his life down, a sacrificial love, that kind of love. And then also in chapter 1:22, he also uses the word Philadelphia, which we've talked about in this book. That's brotherly love, the kind of love that you show a sibling. And that is its own special brand of love, because it's not based on like affection. It's not based on that we have similar personality or similar interests or something. Brotherly love is rooted in your identity. You know, when you have a sibling love, it's because you share something. You share a family name. You share a part of your identity. That whether you like each other or not doesn't really matter, because you're part of, I mean, it matters. But it's not what makes that sibling love. It has to do with what you both belong to. And in Christian community, we all belong to Christ. And that's really the picture he's been building this whole time. Think about right in the beginning, the first image that he gave us of the church. He says, you're like a temple. And each one of us is like a living stone in that temple, placed by God, built on the cornerstone of Jesus. He sets the tone for the whole thing, and then we're built in there, and that's how God does his work in this world, is through this temple. That is a very belonging type of love. And I think that a point that may seem obvious, but actually I think really needs made, is the idea that the Christian life is something that we do together. And you're like, well, of course it's something we do together. Yeah, but actually I think in our society, our Western modern thinking is so individual that most people think of spirituality as just part of my life improvement plan. You know, it's like the diet that I'm on, or it's like the yoga routine that I prefer. That it's just kind of a thing that if I follow Christ, what I'm going to get is a spiritual thing for me in my life. And you will, by the way. You will have a personal, intimate relationship with God, which is amazing and wonderful. But it's not only an individual experience. It is also a corporate experience. And you can't leave that part out of it, because it is so ingrained in who we are. When you received Christ, you didn't just become his son or daughter. You also became a member of his family, and that's part of who you are. And so, you know, when we pray, yes, you should pray on your own, but you should also pray together. We should praise God together. We should go through all of the little ups and downs and steps of life together. We should suffer trials together. When they endure persecution and slander and rejection, he's saying this is something that we do together. And I think that as it says right there, our culture is doing less and less of this. I don't know if you follow this. I'm kind of an amateur sociologist. It's the history teacher in me. I'm so fascinated with how culture evolves. And man, is our culture changing so fast. And I think this is one of the major areas. We're becoming so individualized. The corporate parts of our culture are on the decline like never before. And I came across this study. I thought it was really interesting. It says, many Americans are lonely, and Gen Z most of all, the study finds. Now, I think that's a surprising headline, because when I think loneliness, you know, if I said, what part of a society is at highest risk to be isolated? What would you say? I would say the oldest part of a society. That's kind of the stereotype, is that you need to really be intentional that elderly people especially don't become isolated. Yet, would you believe in our country it is the exact opposite? Watch this. It says, the study published by the Global Health Service company, Cigna, found 46% of U.S. adults report sometimes or always feeling lonely, and 47% report feeling left out. Cigna calls those epidemic levels. This is 2018, by the way. This is pre-pandemic. So I'm certain these numbers are far worse now, like all the numbers in our culture. And you can tell it's 2018 because this is back when we threw the word epidemic around to describe other things than COVID. Anyway, he says, what's more, only around half of Americans say they have meaningful in-person social interactions on a daily basis, such as having an extended conversation with a friend or spending time with family members. Surprisingly, the study found loneliness affects younger Americans more than the elderly. Generation Z, or those between ages 18 and 22, were the loneliest generation, with a loneliness score of 48.3. Think about that. When I think of my life, 18 to 22 was like one of the least lonely chapters of my life. All I did was hang out with my friends all day and all night when I was 18 and 22, right? No, they're the loneliest. Millennials, age 23 to 37, were close behind with a score of 45.3, followed by Generation X, that's my generation, ages 38 to 51, with a loneliness score of 45.1. The so-called greatest generation, you can tell this was written by a millennial. The greatest generation. And by the way, where are the boomers? They skip the boomers completely. They don't want to talk about their parents. The so-called greatest generation, those age 72 or over, ranked as the least lonely with a score of 38.6. This is inverted from what you would expect. They also found 27% of millennials have no close friends. Just think about that for a minute. 22% reported they had no friends at all. And here's the worst one of all. 27% said they don't feel like I need friends. They agreed with that statement. It's so sad. This is the direction our culture is going. And so as usual, the Bible, which has always stood out, standing out more and more in its values. And you say, well, I'm not lonely. I have 500 friends on Facebook. Well, that's not what he means. That is a substitute. And I think that actually he's anticipating something like that because he says that you've purified your souls for a sincere love and so fervently love one another from the heart. He's taking pains to say, I'm not talking about like casual proximity or association that I see lots of people. I'm talking about real love from the heart, actual relationships. That's what matters. That word for sincere, anupokritos, it means not hypocrite. Hypocrites, you know what the word hypocrite means, but you know, in ancient Greece, hypocrites, that's the word for actors. It just means actors. You've seen the masks of comedy and tragedy. Those are hypocrite masks. And so he's saying it's our love is not like that. It's not behind a mask. I actually, when I was in high school, I did plays, and we actually did a production of Antigone. This isn't a picture from my high school production, but it could have been, actually, because we did. Part of the process was we all made a mask for ourselves, and we worked with the art teacher, and the entire play is done in masks. And the masks have these big exaggerated expressions on them. They're actually pretty spooky. And I remember this very weird effect from that is that after hours and hours of rehearsal, you would start to feel kind of disoriented. Because everyone you're talking to has these masks and they're playing these characters. And I remember sometimes at the end of practice when people would take their masks off, you'd almost be surprised to see the face of one of your best friends. They'd almost transformed. You know, it's something really powerful about it. And this is exactly the image that Peter is bringing up. And he's saying our love is not masked. It is a love that takes the mask off. It is a sincere love. When I think of our culture now, I think that we don't wear plaster masks, but we do sit behind computer screens that do a much better job of masking us. Proverbs 27:17 says, as iron sharpens iron, so a friend sharpens a friend. It's one of the most famous passages in the Bible. It's a great bit of wisdom. I'm putting it up here to remind you, though, that the image is of iron sharpening iron, right? It doesn't say, you know, two pieces of iron laying on a table next to each other. Those don't sharpen each other. They have to make contact, is the point. It is in the difficulties, in the drama, and the pain that comes with relationships, that's where the sharpening occurs. And so proximity is not the same as relationship. It's wonderful that we're all sitting in the same room. This is a great opportunity for relationship. But it is not the same thing as relationship. Peter is describing a love that actually impacts each other, where our lives touch for better and sometimes creating tension. Look at the stones in this wall. When I look at that, first of all, you can tell like they've been finely hewn to fit. That's a very tight fit. But they don't look comfortable, do they? You know, when I look at those stones, they're kind of like, they're a little bit in each other's way. And so it is in a finely crafted wall. And so I'm pointing out a point of tension here, a point of resistance. If I get up here and say, you all should have lots of really close relationships, I'm sure there's a part of you that's like, yeah, I want that. And then if you're like me, there's another part that's like, no. I don't want that. So here's how it plays out in my mind. I think I love the idea of being part of something, but not today. You know, today I'll just be on my own. I'm an introvert, if you don't know. I want to spend time with others, but I also want the freedom to do what I want with my time. Don't you resonate with that? And I'm busy. I want to have people I can depend on. And I want to be totally independent. I want you there if I need you, and I want to not need you. I want people to feel like they can depend on me. I do. I want to be needed in small, convenient blocks of time. I want to be known. But as soon as that comes out of my mouth, yeah, but not too well, right? I want to be known, but no, I don't. I want to feel connected to people, but people are messy. and hurtful and annoying. People are people. They just are. And so I think in our culture, we've become experts at having what I call, you know, kind of relationships. Relationships where we're close but not close. We're great at being connected to a lot of people with no real intimacy as part of it. And we think that we will be happier that way, and that is a lie. You will not be happier by having a million associations and no friends. You will not be happier. And the reason is because you are made for relationship. This is, you are made by a relational God. You are made with a purpose, and a major part of that purpose is relating with him and other people. I heard a biologist talking about the human body, and he said, just look at the human body. It is a relationship machine. Just look at your face. You have all of these muscles that are able to create all these expressions, eyes to see, ears to hear, mouth to communicate, right? Like, we are made to relate. And when we lay that aside and say, no, I don't need that, we're denying something deep about who we are. Relationships are what really make us happy. Oh, here's this quote I love from Rick Warren. He says, I have been at the bedside of many people in their final moments when they stand on the edge of eternity. And I have never heard anyone say, bring me my diplomas. I want to look at them one more time. Show me my awards, my medals, that gold watch I was given. When life is ending, people don't surround themselves with objects. What we want around us is people. People we loved and have relationships with. In our final moments, we all realize that relationships are what life is all about. Wisdom is learning that truth sooner rather than later. Oh, that's so well said. So, okay, one more bit of study. I love to point to this study because this is the longest study in American history. I don't know if you know about this famous study. It just wrapped up a few years ago, a 75-year-long Harvard study. They wanted to find out, you know, what makes life more fulfilling. And so they picked these people and they decided to follow them their entire life. It's had like multiple different people in charge of the study because the person in charge keeps retiring. And so, but they followed people for 75 years. It says, for 75 years, Harvard's Grant and Gluck study has tracked the physical and emotional well-being of two populations. Due to the length of the research period, it's required multiple generations of researchers. Since before World War II, they've diligently analyzed blood samples, conducted brain scans once they became available, pored over self-reported surveys, as well as actual interactions with these men to compile the findings. The conclusion? According to Robert Waldinger, director of the Harvard Study of Adult Development, one thing surpasses all the rest in terms of importance. He says the clearest message we got from this 75-year study is this. And you're expecting exercise, healthy eating, right? Good relationships keep us happier and healthier, period. That is the one thing that correlated with happiness and health was relationships. Not how much is in your 401k, not how many conferences you spoke at or keynoted, not how many blog posts you wrote or how many followers you had or how many tech companies you worked for or how much power you wielded there or how much you vested at each. No, the biggest predictor of your happiness and fulfillment overall in life is basically love. This is from Inc. magazine, you know. They are agreeing with Peter. It's love. Specifically, the study demonstrates that having someone to rely on helps your nervous system relax, helps your brain stay healthier for longer, and reduces both emotional as well as physical pain. The data is also very clear that those who feel lonely are more likely to see their physical health decline earlier and die younger. It's not just the number of friends you have, he says. It's not whether you're in a committed relationship, says Waldinger. Now, this is interesting. It's not amount of friends, and it's not just like having a spouse or a good marriage. He says it's the quality of your close relationships that matters. And what that means is this. It doesn't matter whether you have a huge group of friends and go out every weekend, or if you're in the perfect romantic relationship, as if those exist. It's the quality of the relationships, how much vulnerability and depth exist within them, how safe you feel sharing with one another, the extent to which you can relax and be seen for who you truly are and truly see another. Relationships are messy and complicated, acknowledges Waldinger, but he's adamant in his research-backed assessment. The good life is built with good relationships. Amen. It took us a 75-year study to figure that out. But we could have read it right here. You know, Peter was a couple millennia ahead of the game. So here's a challenge to think about. So the challenge here is to be fervent. How fervent is your love these days? Here's a question to think about. Do you expect to acquire new fellow travelers? And I love that term. That's C.S. Lewis refers to friends as fellow travelers. And that picture really helps me because, you know, we're all on this road of life. We're going wherever God leads us. And in his great provision, he gives us people to walk legs of that road with. Sometimes the cast of fellow travelers in your life changes. And that's a hard lesson. I didn't expect that lesson. When I came to Christ among a group of friends, and we became very tight friends. Those became the best friends I had ever had in my life. And many of them are still great friends and fellow travelers in my life. Some of them are not. And I remember feeling angry at God when those people decided they didn't want to follow God anymore, or they wanted to go do something else. But I feel like God reminded me at some point, or taught me, I never promised to give you the same fellow travelers for every leg of the road. I will give you fellow travelers. But be grateful for the ones that you have today. And that really taught me an important lesson, I think, which is that you got to look around your left and right and say, who has God given me today? And that might be different than yesterday. I can be grateful for the fellow travelers he gave me on the last leg. And I can be grateful for the fellow travelers he's given me for this leg. And I can anticipate that he will give me fellow travelers for the next leg. But that's important because I meet people who say, I don't have any friends. All my friends are gone. All my friends have died. Or all my friends have moved on to other things. And they're missing a key point, which is what this question is asking, which is, well, what about getting some new ones? Are you open to, at every chapter in life, letting other people walk alongside you? We should be. What's one step you could take to make an existing relationship more sincere, to take that mask off? This can be hard, especially, I'll speak to the guys here for a minute. It's harder for us guys, I think. Just stereotypically, it's harder for us guys to not be superficial and just talk about whatever's going on in the news or whatever. And so it takes someone being intentional to say, let me share something that's actually going on. Let me reveal that I actually have a feeling or two and I'm able to speak about them. It takes work. What's one thing you could do to stretch out the provision for relationships in your life? How can I put myself out there where I can avail myself to having a growing cast of relationships and not a shrinking one? You say, well, I don't have time. I know, nobody has time. I don't have time to do 95% of what I can dream up that I would like to do in this life. But time issues are priority issues. You know the bucket analogy, have you heard that, where you say time's like a bucket, and let's say you got to fill it with, you've got sand and you've got gravel and you've got rocks. If you put the sand and the gravel in, the rocks won't fit. So what you have to do is you have to put the rocks in and then you pour in the gravel and then you pour in the sand around that. That's a good illustration for priorities. So the point here is that relationships are the rocks. Put those in and let your life be built around those. Prioritize them because they're what life is all about. You say, that's hard. Well, yes, I'll just remind you of the main point of this teaching, which is that we should be fervent. We should stretch out in our love. But then, people are annoying. I know. I'm annoying too. You probably are too. No offense. Most people are somewhat annoying. But just remember these two things. One is they're annoying people for whom Jesus Christ shed his blood. But God values them as precious. And two, remember that in 40 years, we're all going to be in the same home church. And they will be a lot less annoying because they'll be glorified. So just take the long road, you know, take the long view. They'll get better. Later in eternity, you can enjoy them more. He says, and I'm joking, but I do think that Peter anticipates this in the passage. He says, be fervent because love covers a multitude of sins. Why does he bring this up? He's like, you got to love each other because you're going to be close together. You're going to be going through this trial, this pressure cooker together. And so you better love each other because love covers a multitude of sins. Peter presupposes that we're going to have sin and that that sin is going to affect each other and cause problems. And he's like, you're going to need a lot of love if you're going to be close together, a room full of sinners trying to follow Jesus together. He's riffing on Proverbs 10:12. Hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all transgressions. These passages were the topic of Gary's devotional that I just sent out a couple days ago. So if you're interested in this, you should read. It's a good read. The point is that there's always going to be strife. Strife is the price of admission for relationships. Okay, you can quote me on that. Strife is the price of admission for relationships. And you can do two things with that strife. You can add hatred to it, which will stir it up, or you can bring love to it, which will cover. We make a provision. We have a long-suffering patience for one another. This is a gracious love. And I think that he's just describing what he just said in the previous chapter, where he challenged us to be harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, and humble in spirit, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead. Remember that passage? Well, he goes on in verse 9. He says that we should be hospitable to one another without complaint. And this is an interesting challenge as well, to be hospitable. The word there is philoxenos. Xenos is the outsider, the stranger. And philo is love, like Philadelphia is love of the brother. This is love of the stranger. And this is usually a word that you associate with how they're supposed to treat outsiders to their community. So when someone from outside Israel comes to Israel, they're supposed to be hospitable to them and show them love. Here's what's weird about this passage is he says, be hospitable to one another. Right? How is that? That's a contradiction. How, love of the outsider to one another. How does that work? I think the idea here is that he's picturing them bringing each other into one another's homes. Because remember, they're experiencing persecution. They're losing their jobs. They're losing their place to live. They're being ostracized. They're becoming outsiders. And so he says, you will have to show a hospitable love to one another in this circumstance. Pretty interesting. So this is a love that looks out for one another, a community of love. When I think about that wall imagery, one of the cool things about it is you don't just depend on one other stone. You know, each stone is resting on many other stones that are holding up, and each stone is hemmed in by piers on each side, and each stone is doing the work of holding up other stones. And that's a good illustration for a healthy Christian life. You ought to have people that you depend on, look up to. You ought to have people that you're investing in and lifting up. And you ought to have good peers who help you keep your life on the rails, okay? What's cool is when we all have this, then you have a whole network of relationships. And when those people get together on a Tuesday night, that's what a home church is. Right? It's a net, it's a web of real relationships. And this is incredibly tough fabric that gets created by something like this. So that when one member has a crisis, when one member has a problem, it isn't just that they have one friend to turn to. They have many friends who can help minister to them. And those friends have many friends. And so you have a community that is able to rally. I see this all the time in the lives of the people in this room. And you guys tell me stories. I know that you do this for each other. And when you do that, you're living out Peter's command. 1 Cor 12:25, this makes for the harmony among the members so that all the members care for each other. If one part suffers, all the parts suffer with it. And if one part is honored, all the parts are glad. So we are each other's provision for enduring the difficulties in this life. But again, he says, be hospitable to one another without complaint. Peter gets humans, doesn't he? You know, he gets people. He's like, oh yeah, this is a warranted caveat. Don't complain about it. Because let's be honest, bringing another person in your home is inconvenient. We have hosted home church at my house off and on for the last 15 years, including kids. At our peak, we had 30 kids coming over for home church. And we would have, you know, like kids in our house, and we'd all go next door for the Bible study. And let me just tell you, the amount of things that were broken, that were destroyed or defiled in various ways. We had this running joke about we have a sliding closet door and it would get knocked off the rails every single time. At one point, I even had a meeting where I was like, can you guys just not touch this door anymore? Still got knocked off, you know, but it's a good spot for hide and seek or whatever. It will cost you to show hospitality to anyone. But he says, and yet, guys, the whole point is that we should stretch out. This is fervent love. Fervent love says, I'm willing to endure some inconvenience for the sake of loving other people. He says, he brings up the idea of stewardship. The idea that the things that you have aren't really yours. They're on loan from God to be used according to his will. We are stewards of everything we have. And actually, that idea of stewardship drives out the last part of this passage. He says that we are employed in serving one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. What all has God given us? You know, we could go on all day about the grace of God in our lives, the things that God has given us. And he says, all that is your stewardship. Everything I have is from God and should therefore be used for his purpose, by his power, and for his glory. So, love one another with everything you have. That's what he's saying. What do you have? If you have something, use it to love people. Do you have a car? Do you have a house? Great. How can you use that to love one another? Do you have time? Awesome. How can you use that? He says, and then he says, as each one has received a special gift. So this is also the talents that we have, the ways that God has gifted us. Those are to be used in serving one another. That's the word for ministry. Minister to one another by your gifts. God has gifted you in incredible ways, and they all are relevant in this work of loving one another. In other words, you play a vital and unique role. I say this because often one of the lines of attack that I think God's enemy often brings, a lie that we often get accused with, is I don't matter. My gifts are not significant. It wouldn't matter if I was there or not. False. Not according to this. According to this, you're gifted exactly as God has gifted you and placed here for a reason. He says, whoever speaks is to do so as one who's speaking the utterances of God, and whoever serves is to do so as one who is serving by the strength which God supplies. And I think what he's doing here, you know, there are lists of spiritual gifts in the Bible, long lists of, you know, teaching, preaching, prayer, all these different gifts. I think that Peter is generalizing by kind of lumping them all into two categories. There's like speaking gifts and there's serving gifts. He's saying, you know, wherever your gifts fall out, you know, if you have speaking gifts, and that is a need in the pressure cooker, we all need truth. If you can speak, then do it the right way. Speak in reverence to God. Speak as though one giving the utterances of God. And if you're more gifted in serving, if you're more gifted with your hands and your time or your abilities, that's needed as well. It's all hands on deck. And so he says that person should do so as one who is serving by the strength which God supplies. And that implies something. If I'm supposed to use my gifts in a way that I need God's strength, that suggests I'm working pretty hard, right? I'm going hard enough that I need to rely on his strength, is the picture that he's saying. Don't ever believe this lie. I'm not as gifted as others. my role doesn't matter too much. That is not true. You are a finely crafted tool in God's hand to do exactly as he desires. And he made you the way that he made you. I have a friend who likes to say, you're the right man for the job. And he says that when people are complaining. You know, they're like, oh, I don't know, what am I going to do about this? He says, you're the man for the job, right? Like, God's put you there. If you've ever done much work with your hands, you know the value of having the appropriate tool. When I was an early homeowner, I was trying to wire up an outlet, and I had looked up how to do it. My dad came over, and I was trying to get the wires stripped, and I was doing it with a knife. And I was saying, this is so hard. I keep cutting this, and maybe I should use nail clippers. Might help. And my dad was like, do you know about wire strippers? And I'm like, no. You know, what's that? Well, it's a tool for stripping wire. And guess what? It makes it way easier. It's like, pew, right? I went over to a friend's house recently, and he had a tool. You guys know honeysuckle, how irritating it is to try to get rid of honeysuckle. You cut it, it comes back. It always comes back. He had this tool, this long stick on wheels with this little steel hook, and you hook it under the root. I didn't believe it until I saw it, and you pull back, and it pops it out by the root. It's called like a honeysuckle popper. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. It is a tool designed for getting rid of honeysuckle, and it works amazingly. Wow, you know, it's no good for stripping wire, but it's outstanding. You get the point. You're what you're for. And so he's like, whatever you're for, employ it. That's the point. Use it. Play your role. And do it fervently. Do it full stretch. Because that's how God made you. You say, oh, I got home church tonight. I don't really feel like going. I feel that way about 80% of the time. I'm an introvert, I told you. I never want to go anywhere. And, you know, okay, well, why should I go? Well, if I don't go, I might miss out on a provision God has for me. That's true. But that's not the best reason to go. The best reason to go is that the church might miss out on the gifts that I have. They might need a honeysuckle popper that night. And that's the best reason to go. Not, you'll get something out of it. That's a good reason. But a better reason is, what will they get out of it? Because if you're not there, then there's a big hole in our wall. And the wall is weakened. Often the best reason to show up doesn't have anything to do with you at all. You say, what does church have, or what does God have for me in this church? That's a good question. A better question is, what does God have for me to do in this church? And an even better question is, who does God have for me to love? There are no passengers in God's family. Being a role player in the ministry is part of who you are in Christ. These are identity truths. And when we serve together, that's also a good way to build love. Well, he concludes here in verse 11. He says, so that in all things God may be glorified through Jesus Christ, to whom belongs the glory and dominion forever and ever. Amen. He concludes by praising Jesus. And what is the relationship between our fervent love and the praise of Jesus? He says, so that in all things God may be glorified. When we exert effort in loving one another, God is the one who is glorified. It reflects on God, on his reputation, and it shows the world who he is. So that is our essential equipment for enduring the pressure cooker, is fervent love for one another. Isn't that a great passage? What a great passage. So many of the passages in this book are hard or scary. That one's just straightforward, clear as a bell, but just as convicting as all the other ones. So, yeah. All right. Next week, we'll continue on. And I think what comes next is the passage about shepherding the flock. He turns to leaders and addresses leaders. Another great, 1 Peter ends with some real great passages at the end. So we've got those to look forward to. I'm going to pray for us. God, I'm super grateful for this passage. I can't believe how much I have benefited from the fellow travelers that you have faithfully put in my life. And when I talk to some of my friends from high school, and they tell me without exaggeration that they do not have any friends anymore. And I just think, that would be me. That would definitely be me. And yet, I'm so rich in what you've given me. Thank you for the provision we have in one another. Thank you that this is not exclusive to us, but everyone is invited. And I pray that you would call people into this great spiritual family that you've begun, God. Thank you for the great fellowship we'll have together over a meal. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.